from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As of late Thursday afternoon, New York time, the 72-hour ceasefire in Gaza appeared to be holding for its third day, while negotiators scrambled to cobble together an agreement to resolve some of the long-standing issues between them. Late Wednesday, the UN General Assembly took up the matter for the first time. This was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon at the opening of the session of the General Assembly.
The fighting has raised serious questions about respect for the principles of distinction and proportionality in international humanitarian law. Perhaps nothing symbolized more the horror that was unleashed on the people of Gaza than the repeated shelling of UN facilities harboring civilians who had been explicitly told to seek a safe haven there. These attacks were outrageous, unacceptable, and unjustifiable. Yes, we uncovered cases in which weapons were stored in a small number of abandoned buildings. Yes, there were reports that Hamas rockets were fired from near UN premises. Yes, let me be clear. Mere suspicion of militant activity does not justify jeopardizing the lives and safety of many thousands of innocent civilians. International humanitarian law clearly requires protection by all parties of civilians and civilian facilities, including UN staff and UN premises. Our UN flag must be respected and assure protection to those in need. UN shelters must be safe zones, not combat zones. Those who violate this sacred trust must be subject to accountability and justice. In the most recent case of shelling on a UN facility, the Israelis were informed of the coordinates 33 times. Attacks against UN premises, along with other suspected breaches of international law, must be swiftly investigated. Mr. President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, as a Secretary General, I have made repeated visits to the region, including to Gaza. I have seen the scourge of war etched in the faces of women and children. In 2009, I stood before a UNRWA warehouse still smoldering from the aftermath of an Israeli attack. And yet the attacks happened again and again.
Meanwhile, it's been a busy week in Washington, D.C.
As I think everyone knows by now, this first U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit has been the largest gathering we've ever hosted with African heads of state and government, and that includes about 50 motorcades. So I want to begin by thanking the people of Washington, D.C. for helping us host this historic event.
That was President Barack Obama Wednesday as he sat with a number of African heads of state in attendance at the first U.S.-African Summit in Washington, D.C. After apologizing to the people of the nation's capital for the traffic disruptions that were caused by the presence and movement of so many dignitaries around the city, the president outlined the summit agenda.
This summit reflects the reality that even as Africa continues to face great challenges, we're also seeing the emergence of a new, more prosperous Africa. Africa's progress is being led by Africans, including leaders here today. I want to take this opportunity again to thank my fellow leaders for being here. Rather than a lot of prepared speeches, our sessions today were genuine discussions, a chance to truly listen and to try to come together around some pragmatic steps that we can take together. And that's what we've done this week. First, we made important progress in expanding our trade. The $33 billion in new trade and investments that I announced yesterday will help spur African development and support tens of thousands of American jobs. With major new commitments to our Power Africa initiative, we've tripled our goal and now aim to bring electricity to 60 million African homes and businesses. And today I reiterated that we'll continue to work with Congress to achieve a seamless and long-term renewal of the African Growth and Opportunity Act. We agreed that Africa's growth depends, first and foremost, on continued reforms in Africa, by Africans. The leaders here pledged to step up efforts to pursue reforms that attract investment, reduce barriers that stifle trade, especially between African countries, and to promote regional integration. And as I announced yesterday, the United States will increase our support to help build Africa's capacity to trade with itself and with the world. Second, we address good governance, which is a foundation of economic growth in free societies. Some African nations are making impressive progress, but we see troubling restrictions on universal rights. In particular, we agreed to step up our collective efforts against the corruption that costs African economies tens of billions of dollars every year, money that ought to be invested in the people of Africa. Third, we're deepening our security cooperation to meet common threats from terrorism to human trafficking. We're launching a new security governance initiative to help our African countries continue to build strong professional security forces to provide for their own security. And we're starting with Kenya, Niger, Mali, Nigeria, Ghana, and Tunisia. During our discussions, our West African partners made it clear that they want to increase their capacity to respond to crises. So the United States will launch a new effort to bolster the region's early warning and response network and increase their ability to share information about emerging crises. We also agreed to make significant new investments in African peacekeeping. The United States will provide additional equipment to African peacekeepers in Somalia and the Central African Republic. We will support the African Union's efforts to strengthen its peacekeeping institutions. And most importantly, we're launching a new African peacekeeping rapid response partnership with the goal of quickly deploying African peacekeepers in support of UN or AU missions. And we'll join with six countries that in recent years have demonstrated a track record as peacekeepers: Ghana, Senegal, Rwanda, Tanzania, Ethiopia, and Uganda. And we're going to invite countries beyond Africa to join us in supporting this effort, because the entire world has a stake in the success of peacekeeping in Africa. In closing, I just want to say that this has been an extraordinary event, an extraordinary summit. Given the success that we've had this week, we agreed that summits like this can be a critical part of our work together going forward, a forcing mechanism for decisions and action. So we agreed that the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit will be a recurring event to hold ourselves accountable for our commitments and to sustain our momentum. And I'll strongly encourage my successor to carry on this work, because Africa must know that they will always have a strong and reliable partner in the United States of America.
But the summit takes place within a very complex set of circumstances, with many contradictions and, some say, loud echoes of the continent's history of imperialist exploitation. CPR's Bernard White spoke with Professor Gerald Horn, who currently holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, about the summit. We'll bring you that discussion later in this newscast. Moscow announced a ban on a wide range of food and agricultural products from Europe and the United States, among others, responding to the sanctions that Western nations have imposed on Russia over its policy in Ukraine. We have this report from RT.
Well, Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev has confirmed that all imports into Russia of beef, pork, cheese, poultry and fish from those countries that backed sanctions against Russia are no longer going to be allowed. So that's a ban on all of those things coming in from the EU, the US, Australia, Canada and Norway. Now, in another move, what's been announced on Thursday, a transit for air travel between Ukraine that would have had a transit stop off in Russia is now no longer going to be allowed to enter Russian airspace. So that means if you were going to fly from, say, Kiev to Hong Kong and you had a layover in Moscow, that flight's not going anywhere right now. Now, the Prime Minister also said that this was a unique chance with regards to the ban on imports of agricultural goods from Europe and elsewhere, that this was a unique chance to solve the problems within Russia's own industry and agricultural sectors. He also said that there was a... if their partners around the world, if their Western partners were to take a more reasonable stance regarding sanctions against Russia, that this import ban could be looked at again and perhaps removed. But in terms of, from right here in Europe, how important the import how important, I beg your pardon, the export of European goods into Russia are. The agricultural imports from right here last year alone were worth 11.8 billion euros. So that is now going to be, that's not going to exist in the next year for European companies to make that type of money. It's a huge chunk of cash that is no longer going to be there because of this ban.
Meanwhile, a Russian team of investigators said it's in possession of solid evidence that the Ukrainian government forces have used internationally prohibited weapons against civilians in East Ukraine. We have this report from Press TV.
Russian detectives say they have proof that prohibited weapons such as phosphorus bombs have been used against civilians in eastern Ukraine. Russia's investigative committee spokesman Vladimir Markin says the committee has gained irrefutable evidence during investigations into a criminal case that alleges Ukraine used banned weaponry in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. Markin says the materials could be handed over to international courts for further review. Pro-Russia militias in eastern Ukraine have repeatedly accused Kiev forces of using phosphorus bombs, which are banned by the Geneva Convention.
American journalist Pat Lancaster has been in eastern Ukraine for the past 4 months. Early Thursday, he gave us this report from an elementary school in Donetsk that was hit by artillery fire late Wednesday.
The locals tell us last night at about 6 p.m. there was an artillery strike, and many of the shells hit the school. We've taken a tour of the school, and there's many classrooms that have, all the windows have been knocked in. There's shrapnel has gone into the rooms and even into some of the books and blackboards. And there's just a lot of damage to this school. Luckily, school was out and no one was here. The locals tell us there wasn't any injuries here. But the fact that the artillery strikes the school is very confusing. The locals don't understand why there was an attack here.
And our interview with Patrick this past Saturday took place shortly after he and some colleagues had returned from a couple of days in captivity after being picked up by Ukrainian military and security forces. We bring you now the fourth and final installment of that interview.
On the way back from Slavyansk, I was on a bus, and we were traveling through Kramatorsk, and we made it to the south side of Kramatorsk, where there's a Ukrainian army checkpoint. And at that point, the bus stopped, and the soldiers who were wearing the Berkut insignias and the Ukrainian flag was flying there because it was well in the Ukrainian territory. Mm-hmm. They had all the men get off the bus, and they checked all the documents. They checked our documents, and we showed them our passports, The only press credentials we actually had at the time were the Donetsk People's Republic press passes that are given by the local administration building here in Donetsk,
right,
by the press center.
Right.
And eventually we had to show them that. But the soldiers seemed unsure what to do with us because they didn't know. But then they told us, wait. They kept the bus waiting. They said, someone will come soon. And then three masked soldiers that seemed to be a little bit more high ranking came over and took our documents and then told us we had to wait longer. But finally, after about 2 hours of us waiting there, they sent our bus on. And they had our bus just leave us there, and they told us we could not take our bus. We had to stay and wait for the security service, they called it. And then two men came and introduced themselves as members of the SBU, and then they looked at our documents, asked us many questions, and then informed us that we were going to be detained overnight. So they took us into the Kramatorsk, and they held us in it wasn't really a hotel or an apartment building. It was this big building with many different rooms, with like old Soviet-style apartments where there was the different rooms and shared bathrooms.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly what the function of the building was
basis. Like a youth hostel maybe or something?
It seemed a little bit like that, only a little bit non-commercial. I don't know if it was actually a government building, like housing facility or what it was. But they kept us there overnight, they said, in order to check our documents.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly what they were checking. And they were a bit upset that we weren't in the Kiev authorized journalist database.
Right.
And it's actually kind of difficult for freelancers to get on that database, especially if you don't publish, totally pro-Ukrainian material.
Right. Let me just interrupt you for a second and ask you, were you, among the documents you were carrying, were you carrying your American passport?
Yes, they took my American passport.
And your colleague that was detained, what nationality and what document?
Well, there was two other colleagues detained. One was American. He had an American passport. And the other was British, and he used his British passport.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if they were going to check, one place they could check is with the embassies, I guess, right?
We actually were able to contact our embassies that evening. Mm-hmm. As far as the American embassy, they actually, kind of surprisingly, really helped a lot. The first night they got all our information if there was anybody they needed to contact, and then by that next morning we were actually able to they were able to get in touch with the SBU and the people that were detaining us, and they seemed to communicate some sort of arrangement where we would be released. And finally, the SBU members came back in the morning and told us that they had checked our passports, but we can go, but they strongly recommend we don't go to Donetsk.
Mm.
They recommended that we go more to the north and west, but we told them we understand the recommendation, but if we're free to do what we want, we wish to return to Donetsk to cover what we can there.
So what's going on there now? What's the mood like in Donetsk? What are people doing? What's the daily, day-to-day like? And maybe you could describe that.
Well, the day-to-day activity is every night we hear gunfire and explosions. In the distance, I'm actually staying fairly close to the center. But every day we hear explosions coming from the area of the train station or the area of the airport. It's kind of the common thing that there are explosions. I mean, every few days there's a civilian home blown up or burned down by the Ukrainian army fire. For the last 2 weeks, at least once, one day during the week, there has been hundreds of civilians trapped at the train station because of the shelling around the train station, and they've had to be evacuated by city bus. That's the day-to-day activities. People are still walking around the streets. I mean, not as much as normal, but there's still life in Donetsk. I'd say maybe 50-70% of the businesses are closed most days.
Patrick will be back tomorrow to provide us with an update of events on the ground in Donetsk and the eastern Ukraine region. As we reported earlier in the week, it appears the U.S. has a new whistleblower leaking secrets on its surveillance programs. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern spoke with RT's Sean Thomas about the case of the newest NSA whistleblower.
You see, we have something sacred in this country. It's called the United States Constitution. A lot of these practices are expressly forbidden by the Bill of Rights, particularly the Fourth Amendment. And so unless you are willing to say that NSA no longer means National Security Agency, but rather means no such amendment, Well, then this is a gross violation of our constitutional rights. The fact that Congress has covered up for this, that even parts of the judiciary have covered up for it, makes it particularly heinous, because our three branches of government are supposed to check one another, and in this case, they have been blessing these misdeeds.
Now, the United States has put out some very strong statements against Edward Snowden, presumably to try and prevent other whistleblowers in the security establishment from coming forward with leaks of this type. It doesn't seem to be working, does it?
It doesn't, and it's largely due to the way Snowden, the very clever way that he decided, looking at the experiences of NSA executive Thomas Drake and also Bradley or Chelsea Manning, he realized that, number one, he had to get out of Dodge. You know, that's our expression for getting out of the U.S., and that he had to find a country where there was no extradition treaty. That's why he picked Hong Kong. And when I saw him with three of my colleagues, and when we saw him in October in Moscow, he was very much relieved that what he had feared the most was that he would have done all this, risked and endangered his future and even his life, and nothing would happen. We told him, "Are you still afraid of that?" He smiled broadly and said, "No, I think that things are starting to happen." And then he looked at Tom Drake and he realized, here's the guy who experienced 4 years of torture from the Justice Department, mm-hmm. nine lawyers on the case, okay, to accuse him falsely of treason. He said, "I looked at Tom and I saw this is the guy who's responsible for giving me the example that I couldn't go through proper channels. I had to get out of Dodge." And Tom looked at him and said, "You know, I never thought any good could come out of those 4 years, but this is good."
Meanwhile, there were reports in Russian media on Thursday that Edward Snowden, who's had asylum in Russia for the past year, has been given 3 years additional time in the country. We'll have more on that tomorrow. Professor Gerald Horn holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He spoke Thursday with CPR's Bernard White about President Obama's recent African summit and the U.S. history with Africa, China's relationship with the continent, and much more.
I think that mainstream media has a point when it suggests that the United States is trying to play catch-up ball with China. That is to say that as our presence in North America suggests, that is to say the presence of we people of African descent, there has been a long-standing relationship between North America and Africa and the United States and Africa, going back to the bad old days of the African slave trade. And it's no exaggeration, as Walter Rodney, the great Guyanese historian, suggested in his book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, that not only the United States, but the Europeans, the Western Europeans in particular, France, Portugal, Britain in particular, got fat as a result of the exploitation of Africa, which makes it all the more curious, if not laughable, that now the United States and its European allies are posing as protectors of Africa, protecting the Africans against the big bad wolf that is presumed to be China. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, it's interesting that during the bad old days, the Europeans went into Africa to plunder labor and resources, whereas the United States basically decided to bring the Africans here to exploit them. I mean, that's the central difference between them. I'll leave it to you to determine which was worse. But now it seems that Africans are supposed to see China as the antagonist and China as the enemy. What's going on, in fact, is that the Europeans and the United States are very concerned that as they look into their crystal ball, China will have an economy that's larger than theirs. Indeed, the Financial Times of London on April 30th, 2014, in a front-page story, reported that by the end of this year, the Chinese economy will be larger than the U.S. economy, the first time since 1872, that the United States has not had the largest economy on this small planet. And obviously, this is found to be alarming in Washington and on Wall Street. So therefore, you have the summit that took place, and a central platform that emerged was supposedly this idea of helping to build power plants in China, which is interesting. It's interesting on a number of levels. Number one, a major beneficiary of this initiative will be GE, or General Electric, which is headed by Jeffrey Immelt, who happens to be one of President Obama's closest comrades in the business world, which is quite unusual for a number of reasons. Number one, historically, manufacturing companies like GE, which manufactures air turbines, dishwashers, appliances, etc., who and therefore employ many workers, have not necessarily these corporations have usually been closer to the Republicans because their workers are unionized and oftentimes are supportive of the Democrats. But GE is flipping that script. The second thing that's interesting about this power plant initiative is that it's going to be dependent upon the continuing functioning of the Export-Import Bank, which is a U.S. government entity that helps to finance things like power plants. But the right-wing barbarians in Congress, for various reasons, and I should say in all fairness, assisted by many forces on the left, feel that the Export-Import Bank needs to be junked. They will probably prove to be victorious within a few weeks, which calls into question the major initiative of this summit. That is to say, the Export-Import Bank won't be around to finance these power plants to Africa, and so therefore it makes you wonder about what this summit was all about. The third point that's interesting is that China realizes what's going on, and so it has made an initiative for the United States and China to work cooperatively in helping to build electrification in Africa, particularly with regard to building an important dam in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Now, this puts Washington on the spot for many reasons. One, it helps to diffuse this idea of a new Cold War between Washington and Beijing if they're going to be cooperating in Africa, which is seen as a strategic site for contestation. Secondly, many environmentalists on this side of the Atlantic don't like the idea of building power plants. But the overriding concern and consideration, it seems to me, that you should take away is that Africans benefit if there is competition for their labor and resources. One of the problems that has befallen the continent in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union is that the leverage that African nations had when they could threaten to take their business to Moscow basically collapsed with the Soviet Union. And that allowed Washington and its NATO allies free play and free reign in terms of exploiting African nations. But now with the rise of China, you see that the leverage of the African nations has improved, which of course is alarming to Washington and its NATO allies, and therefore they planted a seed which I'm afraid quite typically has blossomed even amongst the left-wing friends of ours that suggests that Africans should be leery of China. Although if you look at Brazil, which has the largest population of African descent outside of Nigeria, it's quite interesting that in recent years, Brazil has surged into being one of the top 10 economies in the world, at the same time that China has replaced the United States as Brazil's major trading partner. Now, I don't think that's just correlation. I think that's causation. And I think that one, now, of course, we can have criticisms of Chinese policies in Africa, and we can get into that. I can go into that in some detail if you're interested. But the fact of the matter is that one benefit that Chinese policies have over U.S. policies historically is that whereas the U.S. and its European allies exploited the labor and the resources shamelessly of African nations, what happens is that the Chinese oftentimes leave infrastructure behind when they take away resources. Infrastructure meaning roads, highways, bridges, dams, and the like. And so, irrespective of what happens to China in coming years, that infrastructure will be there.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.